You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/bcp.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Brookings this morning. My name is Bruce Jones. I'm the Vice President for Foreign Policy. I also co-chair, along with David Victor, the Cross Brookings Initiative on Energy and Climate. And on behalf of that group and Charlie Ebinger and the whole foreign policy program, it's a real delight to welcome you all here this morning for what I think is an extremely special event. It was just over 40 years ago, just after the 1973 oil crisis that shocked the American economy and our national security thinking, that Amory Lovins published an article in Foreign Affairs that radically altered the landscape of U.S. energy strategy and thinking. In his landmark piece, he argued to U.S. policymakers that we should move away from fossil fuels and towards energy efficiency and renewable energy as a core strategy for both our economy and for our security. And he drew attention to the ways in which clean energy could only not only strengthen our energy independence, but also our national security and our role as a leader in nuclear nonproliferation. It was an article that was lauded by many, and as these things are, criticized by many at the time, and drew a great deal of testimony and debate across the policy community and across the country, and became the most reprinted article of foreign affairs ever to this day. The issues that Amory tackled 40 years ago are still critically important for this country. How we think about energy security, how we think about the role of energy in our economy, and how we think about climate change remain crucial issues in the national debate. Granted, you would never know that from watching the current election, but they are still crucial issues in the debate. And by the way, I work for an NGO, so we have to do a little advertising, and I would encourage you to go to Brookings, just Google Brookings Election 2016, and you'll see some terrific papers on climate change and energy security and what it means for the country at this juncture. And the fact that our politicians are ignoring it doesn't mean that we should as citizens. So I'd encourage you to take a look at those. The ideas that Amory talked about 40 years ago and the notion of what was then a radical idea of low-cost, zero-emission, consumer-focused power is increasingly a potential reality as technology shifts and as the urgency of tackling climate change grows in both the national and the global consciousness. And nuclear proliferation and energy security remain vital aspects of American foreign policy. At the same time, of course, I think there's a kind of growing concern with the questions of energy access, for the poor, energy use in the developing world. And so there's still a serious debate to be had about the relative balance between low-cost renewables and other sources of energy and how we fuel the global economy in the literal sense of that word. I am delighted on behalf of my colleagues here at Brookings to welcome Amory here this morning to talk about his article and what's happened the 40 years since. As you all know, Amory is the co-founder and the chief scientist at the Rocky Mountain Institute. Over the past four decades, he's served as a consultant and an advisor to 65 countries. He's published 31 books. We don't like to admit those things at places like Brookings, where we like to think of ourselves as doing a good job in publishing books, but Amory is outclassing us there. He was named by Time as one of the 100 most influential people in the world, and we're delighted to welcome here today. We'll be followed. He'll speak for a little while, and then we'll be followed by a panel that Charlie will introduce. A very distinguished panel to give you some reflections on his thoughts and where we are in energy security today. So with that, please join me in welcoming Amory to the stage.
Well, thank you for this opportunity to reflect on an article that many believe reframed the energy problem and our responses to it, both in America and abroad. Is the amplification working? Good. That article, the most reprinted and the longest in the history of Foreign Affairs magazine, was published, here's the first edition, it says 17 September 1976. And with the help of many friends, it had worked through a dozen drafts spanning over a year. I wrote it starting in 75 because U.S. energy policy was simply stuck. In the initial policy responses to the 73 oil shock were confused and ineffectual. simply drilling more oil and gas wells, mining more coal, building more coal and nuclear power plants, perhaps pursuing synthetic fuels, had strong proponents, but they were starting to look, as people dug into the numbers, too costly, dirty, slow, and difficult. They weren't even economically self-consistent because their marginal costs were so high that you'd have to raise the energy prices high enough that there wouldn't be enough demand to pay for that costly supply, unless price elasticity were approximately zero, as many utilities at that time tacitly assumed. It seemed to me that these unworkable solutions came from misstating the problem as how to get more energy, more of any kind from any source at any price. So I introduced the simple but radical notion of end use, asking first what services we wanted the energy to provide, like hot showers, cold beer, mobility, comfort, smelted alumina, baked bread, and then asking how much energy of what kind or quality at what scale from what source could do each of those tasks in the cheapest way. Soon my end-use emphasis melded with Roger Sant's least cost language, which resonated with the free market economics that soon emerged under President Reagan. And that fusion is now called the end-use least cost approach, and ever since it has provided superior foresight into competitive market outcomes and has become widely accepted. The publication process was quite an odyssey. The magazine's impressive and eminent editor, Bill Bundy, was somewhat disposed to take seriously such unfashionable notions as efficiency and even renewables, which many considered outlandish and completely impractical, because his wife, Mary Bundy, whom we have the honor to have with us today, she is also Dean Acheson's daughter, by the way, and the Acheson-Lilienthal report and all that. Mary and another lady, Janet Lowenthal, whose husband Abe worked with Bill at the Council on Foreign Relations, and she worked for Dick Gardner at Princeton, they had been feeding Bill for some time some supportive articles. So he was a little bit softened up, but he was quite skeptical that the article belonged there or that I would stand hitched for all the editing it would require. And Mary told us at dinner last night about a long, difficult evening in which she struggled to persuade Bill to accept the paper and finally succeeded. And I think, therefore, either the mother or the midwife of the modern energy revolution is here among us, Mary. And then when Bill agreed to try it, he sent it out to two technical referees, Harvey Brooks at Harvard and Carol Wilson at MIT, to get a technical read, and they flatly disagreed. Harvey said he had serious problems with a lot of the numbers. Carol, for whom Bill Martin and I were working at the time, said, well, if they're Amer's numbers, they're probably right. And to his everlasting credit, and this is a great indicator of his quality, Bill said, okay, I'll give it the benefit of the doubt, I'll publish it, and if Harvey doesn't like it, he can write us a letter. So Bill did some wonderful developmental and structural edits, and by about draft 16, it was ready to go. And Bill was temporarily in the hospital when Jennifer Seymour Whitaker and I did the final line edit in, as I recall, about a 14-hour phone conversation from a payphone in a shack in the Maine woods with a hurricane approaching, which, if it happened to veer our way, would take down the wires for a couple of weeks and we'd miss the press date. But the hurricane forebore, and with the marathon phone call, we got it to press. And at first, the article toward the back of this big issue got little attention. They didn't do, you know, features of titles on the front cover in those days. But it turned out that there was an article, I believe the one by Yigal Alon, third article, mine was fifth. So this Israeli official happens to have an article in this issue in which somebody made a mistake drawing the map. And this was taken as a an esoteric but important restatement of an Israeli official about borders in the Middle East. So everybody went running to this issue to see what the fuss was about, and then they couldn't help running across my paper because it was 31 pages, much the longest they'd ever published. So some people started to look at it, and pretty soon the newfangled Xerox machines started humming away with mass mail-outs. It was the equivalent of a Twitter storm. We didn't have an internet, but we had a lot of places in the more august institutions had access to Xerox machines and stamps and envelopes. Some people told me they received between 50 and 100 copies individually from their friends. Everybody was saying, you must read this thing. and the general reaction was either you must read this because it changes everything, or how on earth could such an eminent journal at the heart of the establishment publish such dangerous nonsense? So the battle was royally joined, and I was pleased to learn last night that as it went on, Bill was quite proud of what he'd done, because, you know, it was the first time that energy policy and foreign affairs, foreign policy, got mixed. They had been in completely different silos, but Bill had the courage and the vision to see that it was time they talked to each other. Energy would be at the heart of how the world evolved. And the effect to me as a 28-year-old author was like that of dropping a seed crystal into a supersaturated solution. Suddenly, there's a little crackling noise, and the whole thing takes on a different shape. that is, the energy policy that was stuck suddenly had a different way to look at the problem, and that started to open up solutions that might actually work. The response was swift and rather ferocious. Edison Electric Institute, is Tom Kuhn in the room? Old friend of mine, but they put out a special issue of Electric Perspectives debunking this article, and altogether there were 36 at least critiques, which the late Ray Watts for Senator Gaylord Nelson lovingly compiled in this paperweight of a Senate hearing record over the next year. And it's fine print, and the critiques range from acerbic to spluttering with outrage, together with my tedious responses. And it makes amusing reading today, but the critics were not amused. It's hard to remember how many experts in 76 considered efficiency minor or unreliable or even risky, threatening economic collapse. People literally said we'd be back to caves and candles if we decoupled energy growth from GDP growth. Citi said, obviously, since we're in a market economy, we're already using energy as efficiently as possible. Nothing more can be done. And renewables were thought strange or ridiculous or just technically absurd. But after a year or so, when the dust had begun to settle, ARCO's chief economist, Dr. David Sternlight, neatly captured the conclusion of many of the more sober observers when he said, I, for one, don't care if Levins is only half right. That would be better performance than I've seen from the rest of them. Now, around that time, a year after the paper came out, President Carter called me in for a long, substantive conversation with him and his energy secretary, Jim Schlesinger, later my ally on grid security issues. Missed that guy. And President Carter is a first-rate engineer, and when Jim made three comments, all technical and all incorrect, the president corrected him on all of them. 2 years ago, President Carter told me the article had been exceptionally important in framing his energy policy, and that felt good because I thought, apart from Jim's Synfuels attempt, which soon died of an incurable attack of market forces, the Carter energy policy was the most coherently pro-efficiency and pro-renewables and kind of visionary in architecture energy strategy before or since, and it laid the vital foundations for the investments and attention that led to today's energy revolution. Then over the next decade, many of the article's harshest critics ended up hiring me or my team at Rocky Mountain Institute, which we set up in 82, to help them adopt its recommendations. And by the current decade, places like Public Utilities Fortnightly and Power Engineering International were praising its prescience. So let me rattle on a bit about what did we learn and what should we have learned and where are we headed? Now, first, we learned the value of energy scenarios, which had been pioneered by mainly Pierre Vach, whom I just missed at Royal Dutch Shell, and worked with them ever since. And indeed, these hard and soft path graphs redrawn from the article, I'm told it's the first time they'd ever had graphs, they first took shape in 1975 on Gareth Price's blackboard at Shell Group Planning in London. Scenarios, of course, are not forecasts. Rather, they are powerful vehicles for telling stories that help people understand unfolding events. And at the time, a few groups like the Ford Foundation's Energy Policy Project, led by Dave Freeman here, from whom we will hear shortly, and even the Academy's CONAIS study, were introducing scenarios. They were often scorned by traditional extrapolative or econometric forecasters, but it turned out the scenarios tools proved a lot more useful, and they could be reality checked by a newfangled thing I introduced in the article called backcasting. One contemporary antidote to forecastitis is the three-decade lack of relationship between the wholesale gas price in green and the official forecasts of it in blue. Investors believing forecasts like those have lost their shirts three times now, once for over $100 billion, a fourth one's underway. And the inherent volatility of gas prices, which are worth $2 or $3 a gigajoule, that complicates risk management. It deters finance. But even without counting volatility, efficiency of renewables have a constant price that often beats even the fuel cost of today's combined cycle power plants. And gas heat is also pressed to compete with efficient buildings, industrial processes, cogeneration, even solar process heat. So the new story about abundant and affordable energy for the long haul is less about fracked gas than about its inexhaustible, carbon-free, stably priced physical hedges, efficiency and renewables that are outpacing and increasingly outcompeting it. And together, they and cogeneration in 2013 alone got over $630 billion of global investment. So that transition's well underway. But back to the scenarios, the second thing we learned is to start with why, start with purpose, start with end use. What's the job? What's the right tool for the job? The article was so influential, I think, because it didn't simply propose yet another portfolio of alternative investments, but because it redefined their purpose and their logic. So here are the two curves redrawn from the same data as my 76 article. And on the left, the hard path, as I dubbed it, melded the official forecasts of that time from government and industry, which extrapolated historic growth and built to meet it. And on the right, assuming the same GDP growth, the soft path combined end use and conversion efficiency with right quality, right size, renewable, and widely accessible supplies, which I dubbed soft technologies. Friends like the anthropologist Margaret Mead then belatedly pointed out that this terminology might arouse anxieties in the middle-aged men who run the world, but by then it was too late to change the language, and ultimately it was sufficiently accepted that now when Joe Nye spread soft power all over, that term seems at least outwardly to have been accepted in this more gender-balanced age. Let's dissect how well the soft path graph resembled reality, and let's start on the demand side. That's the good news. Now, my soft path graph was explicitly not a forecast, although it is still often misinterpreted as one. It simply described what I felt was possible and plausible, however unfamiliar. And this eye chart is from a paper by John Kumi, who we'll hear from later, with Ashok Adgill and Paul Craig at Berkeley Lab, 2002. And they found my soft path curve was the only published mid-70s view of U.S. energy demand in 2000 that actually proved accurate. It was 0.8 or 4.0% above actual demand, respectively, with or without renormalizing to actual GDP growth. So the big black dot representing my suggestion for 2000 energy demand is rightly described by those authors as impressionistic, but driven by a large number of engineering and economic calculations. And it actually proved more useful than the best econometric tools of the time, and those ended up typically 50 to 100% too high, sometimes far more. Berkeley Lab study also assembled grades from both traditional and reformist energy experts for a variety of leading energy studies of that period. Mine scored A on influence and E on technical quality. In fairness to the reviewers, the book-length technical backup wasn't published for at least another half year. So I think a lot of folks didn't realize initially I wasn't just making stuff up. And the authors of this Ought-To paper commented, one major theme that emerges from this study is that the interviewees' assessments differed enormously regarding quality and influence, and that there was little correlation between the two. The survey authors observed that studies generally regarded as high in quality tend to be non-controversial and integrative in nature. In reflecting ideas already known and accepted, they are not as likely to attract attention and exert influence, other things being equal, as studies with striking and fiery conclusions. Another theme, they continued, is that the assessment of analytical strength is correlated with the views of the reviewers. So my paper, Ford Energy Policy Project, Stobal and Juergen studies, show the extremes most clearly. Both found favors with reviewers favoring renewables, whereas analysts who preferred traditional energy systems such as coal and nuclear power found them technically flawed. Little has changed in the intervening quarter century. And the same is now true 14 years later. Minds in this business rife with what anthropologists would call energy tribalism change mainly one death at a time, and even that is no longer a reliable method. Some of the first generation nuclear advocates, like my late friend Alvin Weinberg, were expert and well-informed and honest, but I can't say the same for the new generation of virulent and often under-informed enthusiasts who continue to distort policy and misallocate capital. Now, what happened after 2000? Let's zoom out at energy savings. Remember that in 75, our government and industry were virtually all in agreement that the energy needed to make a dollar of GDP couldn't fall. A year later, my article heretically suggested it could drop 72% in 50 years. So far, it's dropped 56% in 40 years. And yet, just the innovations already made by 2010 in far more powerful technologies and design methods, enlightened regulation, maturing financing and marketing and delivery channels, can now save another threefold, twice what I originally thought, at a third the real cost. And now, 6 years later, even that looks conservative. An important feature hidden within these aggregates, by the way, is that so far U.S. electric intensity has fallen only half as fast as fuel intensity. There are about 10 good reasons for that, including the way two-thirds of our states still reward utilities for selling you more energy and penalize them for cutting your bill. But as that perversity is slowly reformed and other causes fade, electricity demand, too, has been falling in absolute terms since 2007. As in most industrialized countries. And in the long run, in the U.S., it could well keep falling by 1% a year, despite complete electrification of the auto fleet and robust economic growth. Now, forecast demand moderated, but on the supply side, the soft path happened only in states like California that consistently pursued it. At the national level, powerful lobbies, and hence federal policy, strongly favored the hard supply path. So on the left, I've redrawn my 76 soft path graph to add, based on the information available in 76, both nuclear power and hydropower, which the original graph left out because they were relatively small and constant. And then came my illustrative sketches of how soft technologies, oil, gas, and coal could behave. Okay, what actually happened? What actually happened on the right differs for three main reasons that affect each element of supply. First of all, natural gas in gray was thought in 76 to be a scarce byproduct of dwindling oil, so federal policy outlawed its power plant use from 1978 to 87 and strongly promoted massive expansion of coal fire generation, red, instead, as well as nuclear power subsidized to about 100% of its value. The vast coal fleet was then exempted from Nixon-era environmental laws. And it's only now fading as those rules start to be enforced, even as the newly resurgent gas persists, happily in more efficient combined cycle plants developed in the 80s. So gas and the shift to coal, driven by policy and subsidy and so on, that was the first big shift. Then how about oil, the black wedge, which was supposed to taper right down? Well, once President Ford got auto efficiency standards passed into law in 75, effective 78, U.S. oil intensity fell by an average 5.2% a year. And it turned out we had more market power than OPEC because we could save oil faster than they could conveniently sell less oil. So the resulting 1985-86 oil price crash fostered complacency. Everybody hit the snooze button, and lobbyists were able to persuade Congress to ignore for 20 years for autos, about 17 for light trucks, the legal mandate to ratchet up the efficiency standards in step with technological progress. So light vehicle efficiency worsened from 87 to 04. It took 22 years just to get back to 87 levels of efficiency. The pace of saving oil fell by two-thirds. About 99% of the major gains in powertrain efficiency boosted acceleration instead of saving fuel. John Dingell et al. Blocked legislation until President George W. Bush's Ought-7 update, which was then suspended a year later. So this stagnation wasted two whole turnovers of the car fleet that were supposed to be used to implement the available and cost-effective efficiency. And that's why we have this big fat oil demand continuing while oil interests sought to suppress competing biofuels. So hence our still high, though now declining, oil demand today instead of the far smaller one we should have had by now. Then thirdly, soft technologies. Well, they didn't do that. They did that. And the main reason is that their rapid progress in my soft path was explicitly predicated on aggressive support, but instead it got largely hostile federal policies for 32 of the past 40 years. It's become a political football. Even the fossil fuel firms that belatedly invested in renewables then impatiently dumped them just as they were poised for success. The big structural change that did go well over time was President Carter's PURPA law, which mandated fair competition for independent and distributed generators. That enabled a false dawn of renewables in the early to mid-80s, and though it was weakened by fierce legal and legislative attacks, PURPA ultimately did destroy the rationale for utility monopolies and laid the groundwork for competitive power markets, which have replaced PURPA in half the nation. By the way, in three-fifths of the states, efficiency and demand response can now compete directly against supply. I've been asking for that since 73, so it's coming. So after a long bumpy detour, renewables since about 2010 have finally taken off as originally envisaged in the early part of the soft path curve. It's just 35 years later. And of course, the official econometrically based forecasts have gradually been coming down to approach reality. So the resulting dominance of efficiency gains over renewable additions achieved only half the results sought for my soft path portfolio, as the data revealed through 2015. If America's total energy use had grown with the economy at the 75 level of energy use per dollar GDP, as critics then vehemently insisted was inevitable and essential, we would have used that much energy. Instead, we cut that by more than half, roughly two-thirds through technical efficiency, one-third through structural change. Meanwhile, total renewable energy output doubled, and that's wonderful, and yet it had a cumulative impact 31 times less than the savings. The ratio of headlines is the opposite because the energy you don't use is invisible. No energy company foresaw this efficiency revolution. None today fully realizes that the low-hanging fruit will keep growing back faster than we can pick it. And There are a few other things about the article I would like to mention. How's my time, Charlie? Okay. So among the many elements of that 76 article with a familiar ring 40 years later, readers will pick out some that are still current. Some of them are, for example, political economy of energy choices. That's right with us because the article said, in contrast to the soft path's dependence on pluralistic consumer choice in deploying a myriad of small devices and refinements, the hard path depends on difficult large-scale projects requiring a major social commitment under centralized management. The hard path, sometimes portrayed as the bastion of free enterprise and free markets, would instead be a world of subsidies, $100 billion bailouts, oligopolies, regulations, nationalization, eminent domain, corporate statism. Sound familiar? Or if we go down the list, there's a lot of quite rich intellectual capital that popped up in here that is still being exploited. I want to focus now on the last one. The commitment, said the paper, to a long-term coal economy many times the scale of today's, that is 1976's, makes the doubling of atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration early in the next century, this century, virtually unavoidable, with the prospect then or soon thereafter of substantial and perhaps irreversible changes in global climate. Only the exact date of such changes is in question. Are we there yet? Cue the Clean Power Plan and the Paris Agreement. It's been a long slog. My first professional paper on climate change was in 1968, 48 years ago. Had the scientific community, not just a few industry visionaries like my friends Bob Hefner and the late George Mitchell, understood in 76 that U.S. gas is often unassociated with oil and quite abundant and profitably recoverable from deep and tight formations, at least with pretty high prices, I would have treated it separately from oil and emphasized natural gas rather than advanced coal as a transitional technology used, in quotes, briefly and sparingly to build a bridge to the energy income economy of 2025. Fair enough. That wasn't clear until the last decade. I did expect coal mining would peak at about twice the 1975 level. It actually hit 2.18x. But now coal is squeezed between efficiency, renewables, and gas, and it has a smaller share of total U.S. primary energy than its previous World War II low in 1972. As my article warned, also, dangerous delays in the transition to a post-fossil fuel and climate-safe energy system are exactly what we can expect if we continue to devote so much money, time, skill, fuel, and political will to the hard technologies that are so demanding of them. And our continuing failure to exploit the power of example and market advantage to speed the orderly terminal phase of nuclear power, which provides an innocent-looking civilian cover for weapons programs, continues to blow back on us and create self-inflicted threats from the likes of North Korea, Pakistan, and Iran. I would say that was the article's biggest failure, that I didn't get that across effectively enough. Nonetheless, slowly but with gathering speed, markets have begun to triumph over incumbents' political means of enforcing their natural desire to protect their legacy assets and capabilities. And yet the challenge of speeding that shift remains, and the imperatives of climate, public health, security, development, and democracy heighten its urgency. I had a number of other slides about the energy revolution now coming at us, but I think it's better to go right to the panel, and some of those points will come up in discussion, which I think is going to get pretty rich. Is it time to bring us up?
are with us while we get mic'd up here. While we're waiting to get mic'd up, I think I would be very remiss if I didn't note that one of the people behind this event, in addition to Brookings, has been my dear, longstanding friend Bill Martin, who, of course, was himself Deputy Secretary of Energy previously, and also very involved as, I think, Chief of Staff of Wolf-Lanska in the original founding of the International Energy Agency. I'm delighted to have you here, Bill. It's my great honor to, I cannot imagine, I don't think in my professional career that I've ever had the honor to be on a platform with such four distinguished energy observers, and many of which go back many, many, many years. I'm not going to read the individual bios because you have them in front of you in the interest of time, but simply to say on this panel, we have phenomenal regulatory experience. We have entrepreneurial experience. We have someone like David Freeman who transformed the way the Tennessee Valley Authority thought about their long-term energy planning. We have John Toomey, who's one of the most prolific writers among the younger group of people in the energy field today. And it truly, and my colleague David Victor, of course, who's been in the forefront with the IPCC and many other parts of U.S. energy and international energy and climate policy. So without further ado, I'm going to start the panel. We're going to start with you, Peter, and then we'll go to David, and then we'll go to John and David. So I want to urge the panel to stay within 5 minutes if at all possible.
Normally I write my remarks while the other panelists are speaking, but with apologies to those who heard me say this last night, let me begin with the observation that when I first met Amory, about the time this article came out, he was dominating a basketball court. If I have your attention now, in the state of Maine, there are not many hearing rooms large enough for a major occasion, so an awful lot of the important public proceedings take place on converted basketball courts, and that was the case with the 75-76 Central Maine Power Company rate case, which was primarily about raising the money to pay for the Seabrook nuclear power plant in which CMP was an owner. And Amory arrived at the hearing with a suitcase and a light bulb more or less the size of a football, and the promise that it would, over time, could replace a very large part of the electricity used for lighting and therefore also the heat that had to be taken away by air conditioning. To a 30-year-old, more or less, utility commissioner trying to grapple with the various tentacles of what was then the energy crisis, rising oil prices, electric rates that were to treble in that decade, nuclear power controversies, this was a window opening on a very different world. But the challenge was how to move the actual infrastructure in that direction. After all, Amory would be gone on a plane within 24 hours, leaving behind a group of utility executives who didn't regard this as a particularly congenial set of insights. And that struggle really has continued ever since. Just a few observations of things that struck me in thinking back over these years. Dick Cheney was the White House chief of staff when the article came out. 25 years later, as his energy task force laid out the energy plans for the Bush administration, a hard path recipe if ever there was one. He said memorably that energy efficiency might be a sign of personal virtue, but it was no basis for a national energy strategy. So I think what the point that Amory has already made, and that's made in the original article as well, about exclusivity, about the fact that choosing one path excludes the other, is one of the most important points that one has to absorb. And to illustrate how important and how unabsorbed it is, consider that in many conversations about energy policy today on television, in the media, in the Congress, it's regarded as a sort of solemn and wise statement to say, I'm for an all-of-the-above energy policy. Well, what could be more contradictory to the concept of exclusivity than an all-of-the-above energy policy? You can't have one. Now, when I wrote a few years ago that we're not going to fight world hunger with caviar, and we're not going to eliminate energy shortages with nuclear power, one of the most flattering things that happened to that statement was that it popped up a few months later as a quote from Amory Lovins. And it does have a kind of Lovins-like ring to it, I'm proud to say. If you want another illustration of the fallacy of the all of the above or the non-exclusivity arguments that were made vigorously when Amory's article came out, just look at what's happening now in Illinois, in Ohio, New York, California, where reactors are threatened by a combination of things, low gas prices, their own rising costs, but also renewable energy. And the owners of those plants have turned on renewable development after years of more or less treating it with benign neglect, and are directly going after the renewable portfolio standards, the production tax credits, seeking to curtail the place of renewables and efficiency too in those states' energy futures in order to keep the reactors running and in order to keep the price of electricity high enough to support the reactors. In fact, interestingly enough, no reactor undertaken after Amory's article came out was ever completed. So in that sense, the proposition that we need not build more plants and that the lights would stay on, and for that matter, that we would still reduce oil dependence in the electric sector, has proven to be true. A number of reactors that were under construction were completed. Some of those are the plants that are closing now, but no new ones were built from then on. And the fact is, we haven't missed them. We've missed the billions of dollars that were spent on some of the ones that were canceled, but we haven't missed the plants themselves. We're still left with the rate-making challenges that confronted me on the basketball court 40 years ago. As Amory said, some states have now adopted rate-making methodologies that harmonize energy efficiency, renewables, and paying for their existing infrastructure. But many have not. The entire South is still very much on a hard path, rate-making structure. And I think that in the utility sector remains the greatest challenge in furthering and speeding up the transition to a soft path energy future. It's not really a soft path kind of comment, but perhaps the most succinct statement of this proposition came from a utility CEO, John Rowe, then at the New England Electric System, later the CEO of Exelon, when he said of rate making and energy efficiency, you know, the rat has to smell the cheese. And we're still working on getting the aroma of the cheese to drift into the offices of the, well, let's not call them rats, but the folks who will build the system going forward.
Thank you, Peter. Very interesting as always. David?
You know, to speak about Amory in 5 minutes is the challenge of a lifetime. I've considered myself a first lieutenant in Amory's army for over 40 years now. And of all the people, including myself, in the energy arena, Amory is the only one person that I know that has said the same thing for 40 years and has been right every day, every hour, all those 40 years. And the frustrating thing is that even now when the evidence is overwhelming that Amory foresaw what the future needed to be, we still have intelligent people that are fighting City Hall, that are not accepting the fact that the renewable efficiency option is the low-cost option. And what is frustrating is that the environmental knowledge has reached the point that what Amory is preached, advocated, and sold to a lot of people over a 40-year period used to be desirable. Now it's a matter of life or death for the planet, and we still have people with over 100 IQ that fight it, including a lot some people in this room, I suspect. The issue is whether we human beings are a modern-day version of the dinosaur. Are we using our brains? Are we willing to accept, favorable facts? I view Amory in a somewhat different perspective than I think most anyone else, because I had been advancing these efficiency ideas in the federal government ever since the late 60s with some modest success, but I didn't have a voice. I was talking to myself primarily, and the world at large didn't know about this. Amory gave breadth, depth, understanding, and coherence to the notion that a combination of efficiency and cleaner technologies was an option that made sense. And he has taught the world in a very unmistakable manner, in a way that people like me just never had the ability to do. So I feel like we've had an unwritten partnership where I ran over my lifetime 5 different utilities and tried to implement, with some success occasionally, his ideas, whereas he was educating the world. I must say, though, that Amory's numbers are now as solid as gold, but they haven't always been. His ideas have always been solid as gold, but I have to recite once when I was running a utility in Central Texas, and he came to Austin to teach the city of Austin efficiency. And he gave a lecture, and he was up there with his chalk, and he was telling them they could save this percentage on this and this. And I was his buddy. I just came there and listened. But I do math in my head, and I realized that Amory had them saving 110% of their load. And I went up and whispered to him, and he made a few corrections. It didn't faze him in the least, and it was all okay. But the important thing is the impact that he had on President Carter and some of the other rest of us. The breakdown in American energy policy was the election of Ronald Reagan. I mean, plain and simple. We were on the soft path in 79. The projections were pretty much in line with what Amory was saying, and we haven't been on it since then. You know, the great tragedy was the Clinton administration, where Al Gore is a personal buddy of mine, and I know Bill Clinton. They know as much about this subject as anybody. They didn't do doodly squat in the years that they were in office. That's another story. But Amory is a young man. He's reached the midpoint in his career, and I think that he is going to be around to witness a all-renewable, all-electric economy that is emerging that will hopefully, the real issue is will it emerge in time? That is the big question. Can we persuade the people on Earth that this is not something that is desirable but absolutely necessary, and it is cheaper? What is so frustrating to me is that we fought this fight when it wasn't at all clear that we were right. You know, renewable energy was a kind of a dream back then. Now it is a reality, and still we're not able to move to a simple law like all new power plants have to be greenhouse gas free. No one's even suggesting things as simple as that that are absolutely necessary. Why are we fooling around with taxes, which for 41 years no one has been able to get enacted a tax on carbon? Why are we fooling around with things that incentivize and are maybe when it's life or death? When the DDT was killing the birds, we outlawed it. I mean, the family doctor is telling us that the emission of greenhouse gases is poisoning the environment in plain language. And yet, rather than outlawing it, and we can outlaw it for the future, and we have a better product, we're fooling around with complicated measures that nobody in Paducah, Kentucky can understand, cap and trade and taxes. Somehow or another, we are so wedded to a market solution to things that we've forgotten that the only reason on God's green earth that we have a government is to do the things that we can't do individually. And you can have a carbon tax as high as it is, rich people will buy gas-guzzling cars if they want to. This is an issue that requires 100% participation, and it requires that we take mandatory action, in my view. So the big fight now is, are we going to implement Amory's dream, which has come true, but are we just going to sit by and let the market do it, which it will do over a 50-year period? But which may very well be way too late. So we've got a challenge, and that's the challenge that we face. Are we nimble enough of mind to break the habits that we've had all these years and recognize that even though we don't trust either candidate for president, that the governmental structure is the only structure that we can make things happen that are life or death matters. And this has got to be thought of in the category of a health issue, a health of the planet. So that's kind of where I am, but I will always be a fan of Amory Lovins.
Thank you, David. John?
So I want to call out three conceptual changes that Amory's work first encouraged in us. One is least cost energy services, another is economies of scale, and the third is path dependence. I'll talk about each of these in turn. In the 70s, it was widely believed that energy and GDP had to grow together, and that electricity had to grow at twice the rate of GDP growth. This was known as the ironclad link between energy and GDP. And now we know that people are smart and institutions are innovative, and faced with policy changes and price changes, that they will change their behavior, they will modify their structures, they will change property rights, and they will alter how they think about a product given the right incentives. But it was a radical notion back then to say, if you focused on energy services, on the tasks that people wanted to perform, that you would be able to substantially increase energy productivity. And what we now know is when you think about energy in terms of the tasks we want to perform, there are many options for improving efficiency. In 1974, the American Physical Society published a now famous report that talked about looking at tasks and then thinking about what's called the second law efficiency of those tasks. And what they found at that time was that the overall second law efficiency of the economy was only about 5%. So that meant the prospect for improving energy efficiency was much, much greater than if you focus just on the first law. So if you look at a power plant, new gas combined cycle might be 55 or 60%. Your likelihood of improving that efficiency is limited at 100%, right? Well, by Carnot, even less. But the point is that if you think about the task and say, what do we want to accomplish and what is the least cost and least energy using and least emitting way to do that, there are many different possibilities, and that allows you to achieve very substantial efficiency improvements. The second important point is economies of scale. Now, in the utility industry, historically, it had been very important to scale up the unit size of power plants. So there was a very rapid improvement in efficiency over time. That drove costs down, that drove use up. It was very powerful. You can call this economies of unit scale. And the industry had it in their mind that this was the only way that you could do anything. You could only improve by making bigger and bigger reactors or bigger and bigger coal plants. And one of Amory's key insights was that there's another kind of economy of scale, economies of manufacturing scale. And if you build a lot of something, you're able to drive down the cost per unit. Typically, this is characterized in terms of what's called the learning rate. So the percentage change in unit cost for a doubling of cumulative production. And what you find in photovoltaics, for example, that learning rate is 20 or 25%. So every time you double cumulative production, costs come down 20 or 25%. And we've shown historically for solar, wind, for cogeneration, for mass-produced technologies, that these rates of learning can continue for decades. And so that power of economies of manufacturing scale was something implicit in Amory's analysis that I think many people at the time didn't understand. But now we know, because of historical developments, that that was true. And then the last key point is path dependence, the idea that our choices now affect our options later, that the future is not a question of fate, it's a question of choice. And that's another radical shift in how people in those days thought about energy futures. I think there are still many people who still have this idea that the future is something that just happens. But really, the future is what we choose. And economies of scale and understanding those energy service task level analyses give you more options, allow you then to choose a future that's inherently more hopeful, that's lower emitting, that's lower cost, and that allows us to accomplish our tasks in a way that is simply better for the planet and better for society.
Thank you. David?
Great. Thank you very much. So it's a year of anniversaries. Brookings turns 100 this year. Amory, your article turns 40. I first learned, the small world it is, I first learned about this from Bill and Mary Bundy, my aunt and uncle, actually. And I learned out about it mainly from Mary, who told me, well, Bill's mother, my great-grandmother, cooked hamburgers and somehow didn't kill all of us because she mostly undercooked hamburgers, about the insights in this piece. And, you know, I have to say, I just want to echo something you said about the editorial process, because I think it's very easy in this business to be controversial. It's hard to be insightful. It's extremely difficult to be controversial and insightful. And it's maybe even harder to get all that published. And I think it's telling that the most controversial, insightful article about energy policy probably ever published was published in a journal that, to that date, I think it published nothing about, or almost nothing about energy, very little about energy. And I think it's a, you know, it's very hard to work in the established journals and swim against the tide. And I want to commend you for constantly swimming against the tide and then getting the tide to turn in your direction in various ways. I want to just make three comments in my 5 minutes about the substance of the article and the debate and the technologies that have unfolded since then. First comment is that when I reread the article, I see it as really two broad arguments. One argument is an argument about efficiency, and there's a lot of data and insight about how it's cheaper to save energy and to focus on tasks, as John says, and functions. People care about cold beer and warm burritos, and they don't want warm beer and cold burritos, and so they're interested in performing the task in the beer and burrito world, and they don't care how much primary energy is used to do that, and we can improve that radically. And I think that clearly that part of the article has really stood the test of time. And there were other people at the time and since who've been working on this. Dave Freeman talked earlier, Art Rosenfeld in California, John Holdren, who later became Harvey Brooks' colleague at Harvard. I mean, a lot of people were talking about this, but you really gave that argument voice. And just to put some numbers on it, when you first wrote the draft of this piece, the total primary energy consumption in the United States economy was about 75 quadrillion BTU. And the typical projections out in the year 2000 were for 120, 130 so-called quads. Some people were 200. Amy showed a chart earlier. And even corrected productions were lower, but still much higher. And today, total primary energy consumption is basically flat at 100 quadrillion BTU. It's really impressive. And it's because of this focus on efficiency. It's partly because the tasks themselves have changed, and so we found ways to generate much greater economic output with smaller primary energy input. And you really, this article helped focus that debate, and I think that's been incredibly important. It's not always pleasant to folks who are in the incumbents. The entire, or most of the power industry is struggling with the reality that power demand is flat, electric power demand is flat. And if you're in a business that in some states in this country require increasing power sales, then that's not a good business necessarily to be in. But I think when you look across the entire industrialized world, you see the same story. Flat primary energy, flat to declining primary energy consumption, and you're starting to see some telltale signs of the same thing in China, maybe eventually in India. It's a really impressive story. Second thing I want to talk about is the other part of the article, which is kind of soft versus hard. And I guess maybe to kind of paraphrase Bill Clinton in a different setting, depends on what you mean by the word soft. And I think when you go back and reread the article, the soft vision was a much more decentralized energy system, probably less dependent upon electricity, much more local production, including local production from coal with fluidized bed combustors and so on, and a lot of renewables. And what's happened since then is we've seen a lot of renewables in particular, but I think in some sense we've seen a hard green version of the original path, which is more renewables, lower emissions than we would have seen otherwise, but much more interconnection through power grids. And in some sense, we have continued to build out a vast machine, a vast electric power machine. And I think one of the interesting points of debate right now is whether that's good or bad, whether we are on the cusp of seeing a real decentralization of the electric power system, or maybe the opposite, a centralization of the power system. I was, as Charlie mentioned, I've spent some large fraction of the last few years of my life working on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, and one of our main findings was that a world that radically reduces emissions is a world that is probably a lot more electrified, and I think one of the open questions is whether that's a decentralized or a centralized electric power system. I had some insomnia last night, so I watched the keynote address for the Bloomberg New Energy Finance annual update on the state of renewables. That cured the insomnia. But one of the things that's interesting to see that in that annual address is they talk about the world, you know, the world leaders, the best renewable energy contracts, and they're all grid-connected, large grid-connected power systems. So there's some parts of the world where you see decentralized power that is becoming more viable, maybe parts of India and so on. But I think the centralization around the grid is actually one of the most interesting things. Last thing I'll say, third thing, is what would you do if you wrote the article differently now than before? And part of Amory's answer, I think exactly right, is about gas. I think it's really interesting that the world of the 1970s was one where we were grappling with resource scarcity, and so we were looking at beyond oil and gas. And what's happened since then is innovation has made resource scarcity almost everywhere a non-problem, at least resource scarcity in a physical sense. The world is awash in hydrocarbons. And we have, in this country at least, moved actually to gas and have not moved beyond oil for a variety of reasons, and Amory talked some about that. I think it's interesting to look back at history and realize that in the 1970s, one of the big questions was, were we going to build 300 or 400 nuclear reactors? Clearly, we didn't do that in this country. In fact, right now, we are in the process of potentially retiring a quarter or a fifth of the fleet. And I think there's a lot of people who are rightly concerned about what that does to the balance of the energy system. If I were writing it today and looking at new questions, I think there are two that really stand out to me. One is climate. Amory mentioned that was discussed in passing in the piece. It seems to me that climate really changes almost everything. And if you need to get to zero emissions, not small reductions in emissions, but zero emissions, you've got to envision an energy system that's really radically different from today's. And I think one of the open questions, as I said earlier, is whether that's a decentralized system or a centralized system. And the last thing I think that's different today is the role of other countries. In the 1970s, Amory could say, the United States can make choices about its nuclear fleet, and the rest of the world will follow. And today, I think the situation is really very different. Much of the frontier of innovation is playing out in the emerging economies. Frankly, what we do in our nuclear fleet is borderline irrelevant for what the rest of the world does, because the frontier for low-cost construction of reactors has moved to Korea in particular, China perhaps. And it's a really different and possibly a more difficult world to operate in, where there's no hegemon, if you like, no country that can, through its own policy, set the tune. Thank you.
I'm going to ask one question, and then in the interest of time, since the expertise we have on the floor, we want to hear from you all. The one thing that bothers me about some of the things we've heard today is, yes, we have made phenomenal strides in the United States, and we know a number of other advanced countries, particularly in Scandinavia, Japan, and elsewhere, have done so too. But how do we really embark on the soft energy path in the emerging markets of the world? Now, Amory has shown us very well that forecasts can be dead wrong by an order of magnitude. But yet, most of the forecasts still show that if we look out to, say, 2040, that over 90% of the growth in primary energy demand is going to be in Asia. And in Asia, we have literally hundreds of millions of people that don't even have a light bulb. And we have, unfortunately, in many of those countries, also very large low cost to produce, not if you count the environmental externalities, coal. India is awash in coal. 10 million people are employed in the coal production movement, whatever, of coal in India. So my concern is, when you have societies like this that do not have cost reflective tariffs, so markets aren't going to probably get you where you want to go, when you have massive power theft, that despite billions of dollars by many, many different donor agencies around the world, have not significantly improved in the last 30 years. And you have, buildings and collection systems in fast-growing economies that often bills don't get to where they're needed, or bribery, bills don't get paid. How do you make these utilities functionally solvent, and yet at the same time do what I think David Freeman has said, we got to move away from fossil fuels altogether. And this is where I think we sometimes get too caught up in the tremendous progress we are making in the developed world and not recognize the very real challenges that if we're really going to deal with climate change, we got to do something about them. Don't expect a response unless you want to, and then we'll go to the floor.
Yeah. 5 years ago, we published a U.S. grant called Benny Fire. Is this working?
Do you want Barn? You want mine?
Sure.
It's on. It's got to focus on task and not necessarily total volume.
So 5 years ago, we published a U.S. grant synthesis called Reinventing Fire. It showed how to run a 2.6-fold then in 2010, using no oil, no coal, no nuclear energy, $5 trillion cheaper than business, requiring no new inventions and no act of Congress, but instead policy shifts subnational, mainly at state. And the transition led by business for profit. So far, first 5 years, that is on track. It's what the market is doing because the private sector spells the $5 trillion, which is just what ought to be happening. This got the attention of China's National Development and Reform Commission, the super ministry that tells most of the other ministries what to do. So they tasked their top energy analysts at their Energy Research Institute in Beijing to see what this would look like for China, with support from the NDRC-sponsored China Energy Foundation China, the Department of, U.S. Department of Energy's Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, and Rocky Mountain Institute. 50-odd experts worked on this for 3 years. The results were published 2 months ago at the G20 in Hangzhou. And the finding was, again, this is their best energy modelers model data examples. It's not foreigners telling China what to do, that China could by 2050 have a sevenfold bigger economy than in 2010, but using today's energy. In other words, sevenfold higher energy productivity, shift 62% of their primary supply off fossil fuel, so that absolute carbon emissions would go down 38% while the economy grew sevenfold. That's a 12-fold gain in carbon productivity, $3.5 trillion cheaper than business as usual. And indeed, our customers for this work were the authors of the 13th Five-Year Plan, which was approved in March, and it strongly influenced and informed that plan and all of Chinese energy strategy, thus helping create the trust and confidence that were important to the U.S.-China climate collaboration at presidential level that then was important to the Paris Agreement. So I feel good about how this is turning out. And now our Beijing office and our many partners there are pivoting to implementation. But to Charlie's important point, China's coal burn actually has declined in each of the past 2 years, despite roughly 6 or 7% a year economic growth. They now have a large surplus of capacity. They're in the process of suspending or canceling 100 or 200 gigawatts of coal plants that are now clearly pre-stranded assets. And the next thing to work on is that their new international development agency is, in effect, the eighth biggest country in driving carbon emissions because it's mostly financing coal plants elsewhere, just like the Bank of Japan is, to try to keep the power plant vendors in business without being properly aligned yet with national climate policy. In India, there are similar things going on. Piyush Goyal, the energy minister, has done a brilliant job of using competitive bidding to bring down renewable costs in just a year or two to already less than imported coal power and within less than a year, less than domestic coal power. So he's recently been remarking that the coal expansion he thought he'd need will not be so necessary because renewables are taking over. And as we have a team now at RMI raising Rwandan electrification to 70% by the middle of 2018, now 24%. I just want to call your attention to what very efficient technologies can do in a decentralized context. The 1.2 billion people without light that Charlie rightly referred to, typically $2 a day or less household income, are spending $38 billion a year on kerosene. If they were a country, those kerosene lamps would be the eighth biggest carbon emitter, and their emissions kill at least 2 million people a year from bad air. Now, it turns out that there are sparks in this long night because in many places now you can get a package, this is just called a Waka Waka, it's a Dutch example, of a very efficient photovoltaic, very efficient LEDs, high-temperature lithium batteries, and good chip controls. And this will shine like that very brightly for 10 hours on one day's charge in the sun or 2 days in the cloud. Or if I crank it down four notches, 150 hours per day's charge. It'll sit up on a Coke bottle, shine down on the table. You can teach your kids to read, particularly your daughters. And this pays back in weeks to months against kerosene. It's like a perpetual annuity giving you a month's extra income per year. There goes the last bit of Rockefeller's 156-year-old kerosene business. So you get this from an entrepreneurial woman in the village. You finance it through scratch cards or through the smartphone that you recharge here off the USB port. This sort of thing is spreading like wildfire, and I think it's an interesting play, David, on your important point about centralized and decentralized. A lot of the decentralized solutions are bubbling up in places where there's no grid and you can't afford a grid, and people are leapfrogging it just like cell phones leapfrog wireline phone companies. And the centralized stuff is also changing economics rather radically because, of course, most of the cost in countries like ours is not to generate the electricity, it's to distribute it. You can bypass that by doing it on your roof, and then you can make the grid resilient so major cascading failures become impossible by design, because 98 or 99% of power failures originate in the grid. So there are a lot of other factors in play, but I think the issues you've raised are the right ones, and in that battle, the decentralized systems are gaining the upper hand.
We need to go to the floor.
One of the nice things about sitting next to Amory is for any question, there's something will come out of his pocket that will give you a demonstration.
We have some mics. Lady here in the front. Please identify yourself and ask a question.
Well, Mitzi. I'm Mitzi Wertheim. I started something 10 years ago called the Energy Conversation, funded by the Defense Department, to get everybody thinking about energy, and Amory was one of our first speakers. My observation about this is we have enough talent to deal with the technical issues. My question is getting the public to understand what needs to be done and demand it. If two-thirds or three-quarters of the U.S. public do not know that we have three branches of government, we have a serious education problem. And I have a suggestion, which that all people who write what I'm going to call an academic or a dense paper have a requirement to write a version for non-technical people with lots of graphs. It's a very complicated story.
Okay, thank you.
And my question is, how do we make that happen? How do we get universities to require it of academics and students and think tanks?
Thank you. Anybody want to take that on?
Just very briefly, I'm not sure you want to be completely successful in your suggestion because there's a lot of academic papers out there. I'm pretty encouraged about this. I agree. Public knowledge about how government functions and so on is abysmal in many respects. But it's pretty extraordinary what's happening in the energy business right now. And this, in some respects, not to be offensive to my colleagues up here, but this used to be a fairly dull industry where you woke up in the morning and kind of you did the same thing you did yesterday. And now everything's changing. And the attention to this by the younger generation is enormous. So I'm actually very encouraged about that. I agree with you, the academic world needs to be more articulate but there's a real step change that's happened over the last decade or so.
I'd just add this comment. It's up to the President of the United States, and he's failed.
Another question? Oh, excuse me.
I actually wonder, though, to what extent major changes in other sectors have ever depended on having a huge majority of the public deeply conversant with the policy debates as they go on. And when Amory's article was published, there was another large monolithic utility, the Bell system. And everybody had either a rotary or a push button hardwired phone. The intelligence in the network was all somewhere between Lily Tomlin and the switches. Without the public being deeply involved in what then transpired in the 80s and 90s, we've gone from that system to one in which the intelligence is here. It's decentralized. It's migrated out to the customers. The old switches that we used to be involved in rate increases as to how to support them, largely irrelevant now, not completely, but largely. And yet the public wasn't, the public was responding to the products and services that were available and the prices, and yes, they had some awareness and feelings about the changes, the elimination of the Bell system, but they weren't reading the academic articles, even the ones that were in plain English for the most part. The force came from elsewhere.
Yeah, this thing has more intelligence, more computing power than the Strategic Air Command had the year I got out of high school.
I'm going to take three questions at a time, and we'll get the panelists to respond.
Hi, I'm Andy Katz. I work for Eversource Energy, so we're one of these utilities on a death spiral, I guess, but I think I still have a job. So just quick preface, I convinced our company to file an amicus brief in support of FERC and the EPSA v. FERC decision for jurisdiction over price-responsive demand, so we won that, and you know, I was inspired by Amory as an early attorney at the FERC.
Can we get to a question?
My question is talking about smelling the cheese. So what we're finding is the standard market design rules in the organized market that we deal in up in New England has a lot of barriers to the transition to the kinds of things that are desirable, the path that we want to be on. And I say specifically treating all electrons the same, regardless of how they're produced. The ISOs, RTOs are neutral with regard to that. And then there's a lot of barriers between, it's really a federalism question, I think. So I throw it out. What kinds of barriers, do you see barriers to achieving these outcomes that we want through federalism and the kind of interaction between state and federal policies?
And we have another question here. Identify yourself, please.
Sure. My name is Ziad Al-Adad, the former director of operations at the World Bank. Excellent, the presentation and the panel, as we expected. My question regards shale gas, actually, tight structures. You mentioned this as a transitional source. How transitional is this actually? You see, the reason I ask this is that we've been having some very, there was a lot of enthusiasm in the earlier years that this is going to fuel a lot of our more benign environmental oriented development. As we went on later, these projections became lower and lower about how much actually is there. Now, of course, there is price elasticity, sensitivity, and so forth. But what is the real picture? How much can the U.S. and then, by extension, the rest of the developing world, if the technology is, in fact, transferred, how much can they really benefit from this transitional source? You alluded to it, and I think, David, you also mentioned something.
We got to move on. Question in the back.
Hi, Peggy Knudsen of Eco America. Hi, Charlie. I worked at Brookings for 8 years. Eco America works with people that people trust, like doctors and rabbis, to message exactly the things that you're saying. This is climate affects our health. So the gentleman right, second from the right seemed to insinuate that the government can do this and we don't need a lot of people on board. On the other end, okay, I'm getting that wrong. But I think it needs to be a combination of policy and people understanding. We throw away 40% of the food we buy, for example. So I guess my question is, you know, how much of this is going to come from above with the policy, and what kind of a campaign do we need to get Americans on board the way we did with smoking, the way we did with other campaigns that got this society completely changed and on the right path?
Okay, let's see what the panelists want to say about any of those.
I think the poll evidence is very strong that there's an overwhelming majority of Americans across the political spectrum who want efficiency of renewables, and sooner or later the government and private sector are going to have to give it to them. And when we now have U.S. energy productivity having more than doubled, and relentlessly driving down oil and electric demand, 68% of our new capacity added last year was renewable. The market's responding very nicely despite all the barriers still in the way. So I don't think this is a problem of lacking grassroots support and Jeffersonian common sense. On the fracking question, speaking for myself, but I'm a member of the National Petroleum Council, I think there have been many bad practices in the industry that give everyone a bad name. We advise our clients to adopt gold standard best practice, which inconveniences their competitors more than themselves. But even if they do that, there are about 8 major issues around fracking, some of which may end up being satisfactorily resolved. Some may not, because 8 is a big number, so I wouldn't bet a lot of money on they're all coming out right. And the depletion curves, the methane leakage, some of the water issues are complex and difficult. Methane leakage is particularly worrying across the entire supply chain and maybe a lot bigger than we thought. I think already we're seeing even operating cost alone for combined cycle gas plants beaten by wind and solar in many places. Then you add to that the price volatility of gas that probably gets worse downstream if you have abundant, cheap wellhead gas. And that volatility, you can deduce from the straddle in the options market, is worth enough to roughly double the gas price. It's really not that cheap. Then the geology is generally a good deal worse in other countries. So I'm not very sanguine about where that's going to go.
If I could just add one sentence. The shale gas is not a transition to anything but a hell. The fatal flaw of the Clean Power Program and the great failure of our president and the current administration is not to recognize that methane for a 20-year period is 100 times as bad as carbon. They don't count methane. If you switch from coal to natural gas, Mother Nature doesn't notice the difference. So it's a big lie that it's a transition. It is just as bad. We're not making progress if we switch from coal to natural gas.